The date is February 11th, 2020, and you're listening to the second podcast of Coronavirus Central, your daily source for information about the novel coronavirus of 2019 pandemic. I am your host, Tom Kaczynski, and as always, we will offer tracking about the number of cases, vital information about the outbreak, major news developments, economic implications, rumors about what is not being reported elsewhere, and helpful advice to protect you and your family. This podcast represents the combined efforts of a public open source information network, which we invite you to join. If you wish to get additional podcasts, they will be at coronaviruscentral.net, which should be up either today or tomorrow. And both informations and questions can be sent to this podcast at coronaviruscentral@pm.me. We are an independent organization working internationally to seek the truth and for the safety of all against this terrible pandemic. Thank you for listening. So we're going to get into the show tonight. It's 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time as I begin working on this, and I apologize that we're having to work on this so late this evening. I had to do things that were inescapable today, but we will have some more updated numbers for the sake of the broadcast, which I think will be useful and interesting to you. So let's start with the daily reported numbers. This is international. As always, we're using the numbers from WuFlu.live. Definitely recommend checking that out for a bunch of information that's interesting about it. And as of 7:27 p.m., the numbers that are being reported publicly are that there are 44,878 confirmed cases, 1,114 people who've died, and 4,690 who are reported as recovered. And I should add to this that they are now calling this COVID-19 instead of the coronavirus. Now, I don't think that name is going to stick, to be honest with you, as much as it's being publicly promoted by the World Health Organization. There were a number of articles out today about why they named it that. And they basically named it COVID-19 because they were trying to have a name that conveyed absolutely nothing, because they were literally more worried about people's reaction to the name than they were about the welfare of the disease. And it's really a sad thing that the World Health Organization, you know, historically, diseases have been named for their point of origin, like MERS, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or something about the disease, SARS, Sudden Acute Respiratory Syndrome. And in this case, they've basically made a name that represents absolutely nothing because they didn't want to offend anyone. And when you see that level of political correctness, I mean, it sort of reeks of the system where we have these numbers, which we have an increasing body of evidence for to suggest are not necessarily accurate. And that's one thing that we should talk about. There's an article today that was posted on Xinhua.net. That's XinHuanet.com from the Xinhua News Agency in Wuhan, where they were talking about there being 13,000 fever patients. And they basically, I'm not going to read the whole article here, but the way they're writing this is it's highly suggestive that there is a much larger number of patients out there than are being reported. It's one of those things where we really have a hard time being absolutely certain what that number is. There is a very interesting video that is getting a little bit of conversation. It was on the show with Steve Bannon that they do. It's called the Pandemic War Room. War Room Pandemic. I apologize for that. And that's going to be on YouTube. We'll put a link in the broadcast for that here. But he was meeting with Miles Guo, who was one of the wealthiest men in China, who presently has asylum in the United States. And he claims from this interview that there are 1.5 million people confirmed infected and over 50,000 dead. And one of the things that is interesting and potentially could offer some degree of corroboration for that is there is a series of interviews out there, and I will try to provide these for you as well, where there were a Chinese news agency he goes under the name of NTD News, was talking with one of the women who worked at actually one of the nursing homes. No, excuse me, the funeral homes. I apologize. That through for NTD TV, you can look up their channel on YouTube, and that they were saying they were running the crematoriums for 24 hours a day, and they were running at absolute full capacity, which would suggest that many hundreds more people are being transported there. There are videos available, easily findable on YouTube or Twitter. Or if you join our Telegram chat at t.me/coronaviruscentral, you'll see they're literally loading up bodies in body bags. At least we presume they're bodies. We didn't get to see what's inside them. But they're handling them certainly like you would handle a dead body in full bio suits, where they're stacking them 7-8 deep. And as such, I think that, you know, we have to, between all the evidence, between the sulfur dioxide flumes that come from the burning of organic waste, between the interviews on the ground with the people in the funeral homes, between the different evidence being presented by people with different networks, we have to presume that the number that what China's supporting with how many people are dying from this probably just is not accurate. And actually, as you know, some of the people have been noticing, the line forms a sort of neat quadratic equation that doesn't actually fit well with other information out there. So I think that's one of the things that we first want to say, is that it's very hard to make good assessments about the severity of this disease because we just do not have accurate numbers. And, you know, it's really hard to speak to that because we've seen in interviews that Xi Jinping has been going out there and he's described the situation as grim, as that it's going to be trying. And, you know, the many quarantines that have been expanding throughout China certainly speak to the level of challenge that they're having. And, of course, we hope that people begin to get better and that, you know, we very much would love this information to be, I don't want to say we'd love for it to be accurate, but we'd love to not believe the worst of all scenarios. But it fits the general premise, and we're going to talk about that a lot more tonight, of why, for economic reasons, we will see potentially a lot of deception coming out from governments, starting with the People's Republic of China, but certainly not restricted to them, given the economic consequences here. So one thing, I just to use a sort of case example, we had talked about the case that was in the Journal of American Medicine in the previous broadcast. Today we're going to talk about something that isn't a case, but is sort of a human petri dish, which is the sad story of the Diamond Princess. For those who aren't aware, that's the cruise ship that's parked off the coast of Yokohama. And one of the things that I've been looking at this evening before we came onto the show was to see, you know, the number of people who were there. And as of right now, there are now 135 cases. And while the Japan Health Ministry is arguing this might be due to some super spreader, there's two very disturbing things that we've seen: the number of cases in under 2 weeks jump from one, presumably, or a very small number, or two, to 135, right, on this boat of where there are 3,800 abroad. But we also know they're only testing people who are showing symptoms, and everyone is kept in quarantine. So this virus has either spread earlier, and we're seeing a very long, drawn-out incubation period play out, which we know from other research is at least 14 days, and there is increasing evidence that that number may need to be as high as 24 or higher, which would be very bad because think about it this way. If people were on a 14-day quarantine and they didn't necessarily show that they were sick until you were on day 21, then you may have just had released a sick person to contaminate healthy people. So that's very concerning. But equally concerning is that Japan said they were unable to provide testing for all the people on this cruise ship because they didn't have enough access to testing kits. And that is a problem that is we've seen in China and we've seen in other places. We're having this critical shortfall of supplies that's needed to get accurate assessment on this test or on these things. And between the different countries, there's been a lot of chatter going back and forth that the testing itself may be somewhat problematic. So we'll have to leave that aside for a moment until we can kind of figure out some more information. I do think it's an interesting point, though. It's not where we're going to hit super hard today, though. We're going to go in a little bit different direction because one of the things that I think a lot of people need to understand but do not is the economic consequences of this. And once again, I'm saying this from an American perspective, but it's true around the world where we're going to go with this. As that, let's start with what China's economic response has been to this. And I will start with, let's see if I have the thing, if it disappeared on me. Give me one second, please. And we will bring this up. So one of the things that I was very concerned about was, you know, how are all these things going to be paid for? What's going on with all these questions? And what we have found in searching for this is that the Chinese Central Bank, and this is once again from Xinhua.net, which is one of China's main news sources, is that China on the 10th, which was yesterday, pumped 129 billion U.S. dollars into the system. And they're doing that, as our central banks are throughout the world, to go ahead and maintain an economy on a basis that's independent from production. So they want the value of stocks and of shares to continue rising to bolster consumer confidence, or in China's case, to make sure that not only does the economy not collapse, but that every manufacturer doesn't pull out, as now we know that there are going to be quarantines going through the end of February. And we've seen companies like, for example, British Airways has shut down all flights into China through March, which is indicative, I think, of the fact that people understand this situation is not getting better. And whether you use the numbers being provided by China itself or whether you believe the numbers are worse than that, the basic pattern holds that this coronavirus is spreading, that's causing major economic disruptions, and that those disruptions could have a very deleterious effect in terms of how we see the different pieces move on the board. And what I mean by that is this, that China manufactures a whole lot of what the world uses. And in certain key areas, they have become an almost singular monopoly when it comes to what industries are putting out there. So why I want to go into that a little bit. I think it's really important for people to understand this. And where we'll start with this is that there is an article that was on the from the CFR, rather, and this was, and for people who don't know the CFR is the Council on Foreign Relations. It's a pretty powerful U.S. think tank that definitely has a outsized influence, let's put it that way, and that we have found that, or rather they have found in response to comments by former, chief economic advisor to President Trump, Gary Cohn, who used to work for Goldman Sachs, the Department of Commerce of the United States, and just so you know where I'm getting this is from the CFR blog dated August 14th, 2019, an article entitled U.S. Dependence on Pharmaceutical Products from China. And I'll just read the first two or three paragraphs of it so you have a flavor of this. Last month, the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission held a hearing on the U.S. growing reliance on China's pharmaceutical products. The topic reminded me of a spirited discussion described in Bob Woodward's book, Fear and Trump in the White House. In the discussion, Gary Cohn, then chief economic advisor to President Trump, argued against a trade war with China by invoking a Department of Commerce study that found that 97% of all antibiotics in the United States came from China. If you're the Chinese and you really just want to, or excuse me, if you want to really just destroy us, just stop sending us antibiotics. Okay. So Cohn's words highlight a security concern associated with pharmaceuticals from China. As Rosemary Gibson noted in her testimony, centralization of the global supply chain of medicines in a single country makes it vulnerable to interruption, whether by mistake or design. If we are dependent on China for thousands of ingredients and raw materials to make our medicine, China could use this dependence as a weapon against us. While the Department of Defense only purchases a small quantity of finished pharmaceuticals from China, about 80% of the active pharmaceutical ingredients, APIs, used to make drugs in the United States are said to come from China and other countries like India. For example, the chemical starting material used to make doxycycline, the recommended treatment for anthrax exposure, comes from China. when an influential Chinese economist earlier this year suggested that Beijing curb its exports of raw materials for antibiotics and vitamins as a countermeasure in the trade war with the United States, the worries surrounding our API dependence to China seemed to be vindicated. Concern about a disruption in the supply chain could explain why the tariffs on Chinese products proposed by the U.S. Trade Representative in May 2019, worth approximately $300 billion, excludes pharmaceuticals, certain pharmaceutical inputs, and select medical goods. And the rest of the article, I'm not going to read the whole thing here, but it's sufficient to say that China basically provides almost all our medicine, and I will pull this to a line. Of these import lines for drugs they were talking about with pharmaceutical products, about 83% were finished drugs and only about 7.5% were APIs. So what that basically means is 83% of the drugs we receive are 83% of the medical imports were finished drugs. And when you look at the numbers, I've had a chance to look on some other sources here, that it looks like not only are 97% of the pharmaceuticals for antibiotics, but as much as 90% of generic drugs are produced in China. And we've seen that, in fact, the United States doesn't even produce antibiotics for the most part. We stopped producing penicillin since 2004. And a lot of other countries are in the same boat as well. So what does this mean? China's industrial manufacturing is not able to produce anywhere near its capacity, if at all, during this quarantine situation. So we were already suffering from reductions of the global supply of antibiotics. One of the problems of the swine flu is that pigs are heavily involved in the production of antibiotics. They actually use pig livers, if I remember right, for things like heparin and whatnot. So and you can look up all the details of that. But suffice it to say that between the bird flu, the swine flu, all these flus, that China's antibiotic capacity production for global distribution had already been hit. Now it's going to go away. And it's not like there's an alternative, because even India, which is the second largest distributor of these finished goods, actually gets their APIs from China. So it's become a critical choke point in the world system, and understandably, given the issues ongoing in China, what we're going to see is that the goods that they need for the antibiotics are probably going to be devoted to domestic use for secondary protection against the coronavirus. Because one of the common things that is done in treatment for viral pneumonia, which is one of the key symptoms of the coronavirus, is you're going to see the administration of antibacterial antibiotics, because you don't want someone who's already very much at risk to experience a secondary infection that could be fatal. And if you want to think of it that way, think of like HIV, how that with HIV, it's not usually the HIV that kills you, but rather the weakened state of your immune system that renders you vulnerable to viruses that otherwise would be defeated, or flus or bacteria or whatever it is. This is a big problem, and this is a choking point, and it's what it means is that, and we've already read some coverage of this to this extent, that China is going to be breaking contracts, or the government of China is going to require those businesses there that would produce some antibiotics as generic manufacturers and ship them to the United States, other Western countries, and other countries throughout the world to instead devote them to their own pandemic. So here's the question that people need to consider. When China, when the coronavirus spreads outside China, if it does, as it looks like it's starting to do, will we be able to get the drugs we need from China, given the fact that they are now caught up in their own terrible epidemic, or will we just have to go without? And to be very clear, for those who don't understand it, I guess it's worth taking a moment to talk about the way supply chains work in just-in-time logistics. In the last few decades, the world has shifted to a global trade interconnected economy with international supply lines. So where once upon a time you would have countries produce their own goods based upon importation of raw goods, certainly as needed, but that most of the production was domestic. now to recognize cost savings efficiencies, what has happened is there is a shift toward, as the article said previously, centralization of where the products are being produced. And with respect to certain key areas, China has become almost a monopoly in terms of how the international supply chain works. However, as you already know, ships are not leaving Shenzhen. They are not traveling across the, you know, between the east coast of China to the west coast of the United States or anywhere else. Travel is starting to grind to a halt. Manufacturing production is going to halt, and the stores and supplies that existed in the United States were already pretty much down to a minimal level, as they are in a lot of other cases. I don't know every specific country, but I recommend you look at the status of your supplies. And if you don't know, there's a really nice cheat way you can figure it out, which is to see if the prices and availability of drugs are going up that you could get access to, because a lot of generic drugs that are produced are all produced in China. So if you see as those supplies go down and the prices go up, or availability becomes curtailed, it'll become really obvious what the problem is. So as we go through this year, if and as the coronavirus expands, and we have every reason to think it will, especially since we've seen on this ship now that is expanding very, very quickly. In the course of 2 weeks, we're now up to, 135 people from theoretically having a very small number of people infected. We don't know how many it was originally, but we know they were only looking at four a few weeks ago, and now we've seen it jump to 135. Which, if you were working it out as an exponential progression model, assuming a one-week time frame for how long it was taking for this to go, that would recommend a transmission rate, an R-naught, of somewhere between 5 and 6. And the media has made a big point about talking about super spreaders, which are people who, for whatever reason, are more virulent in terms of the number of people they spread these diseases or this virus to. We don't know that that's the case. I don't know if that's more or less comforting, but what we do know is that it averages out to somewhere between 5 and 6 in terms of how many people are getting each other's, or actually this is over 2 weeks, so that wouldn't even be right. You'd have an R-naught, that's if you had 3 weeks, or if you had a period of 5 days, which may very well be possible. So it could be a transmissible period of an average of 5 days, where you would have it be an R-naught of 5, which is 125, that's pretty close. It'd be slightly over 5. Or if it's 2 weeks, like I'm originally suggesting, then the number to equal that would have to be an R-naught of about 11.5, which is even more terrifying in a lot of ways. But these are the problems we have. So I think when you look at the numbers, you have to conclude that the coronavirus is going to spread. We don't know yet how severe it is in terms of the mass exposure, because it's very possible, and a number of people have suggested, as has Dr. John Campbell, based upon his own research on YouTube, which is very good, that the number of people who are getting this really, really bad may be inflated the lethality of this is inflated by the fact that people are not reporting to hospitals who get sick and get better without realizing they were ever in such bad shape. And that would certainly be good news if the severity of coronavirus wasn't that bad. His own off the back of the handkerchief calculations. And I'll try to share these with you as well in the links at the bottom of this, are that there was between 10 and 16% of people who ended up having to need urgent care, which we, in terms of how we talked about this, was the severity of people being treated. But in a country using China, of 1.3 billion people, even a 10%, you're still talking about 130 million people. Which is a terrible position to be in when the ICU capacities, the oxygen capacities you need to fight these viral pneumonias, aren't anywhere near meeting this. And I say all this as background to the point that this problem with the coronavirus, even if the number is just 1%, still makes, by taking China out of the game, has basically created a global bottleneck with respect to certain supplies. One of the examples, and we'll go through them real fast here. We'll use the example of what the United States imports from China. And for the purposes of this sharing here, TRG is what I'm using for this. That's called TradeRiskGuarantee.com. And it talks about what the top 10 U.S. imports are. And this is from 2018. I don't think the full 2019 numbers are out, but that's okay. We're just talking about sectors, and I'm sure the numbers are pretty consistent given the supply chains. There's probably a little bit changed, but not a big deal. So the major U.S. imports, and these are by category, we'll just read through them real fast so you have this, is machinery, $386.4 billion, electrical machinery, $367.1 billion, vehicles, $306.7 billion, minerals, fuel, and oil, $241.4 billion, pharmaceuticals, $116.3 billion, medical equipment and supplies, $93.4 billion, furniture, lighting, and signs, $72.1 billion, plastics, $61.9 billion, gems and precious minerals, $60.8 billion, and organic chemicals, $54.6 billion. And just to put it in perspective for you, America receives, of all the imports America receives, 18.2% come from China, which is larger than the second and third largest countries, which are Mexico at 14.4% and Canada at 12.7%. And I just go into that level of detail for one reason, so you can see what things are going to be hard to get because they're just not going to be coming. So if you have computers, anything in telecommunications, certain raw materials, pharmaceuticals, plastics, things with lighting, they produce most of the LEDs and a lot of gems, they're not coming. And for some of those things, we can do without computer parts. It will be unpleasant, I'm sure, but whatever. But the problem is with this medical equipment and supplies category, we basically now are standing on the edge of a pandemic that will be of some degree of intensity, knowing that our supplies to medicine, we're pretty much going to have to roll with what we get, and we're not going to get any resupply. This is why the novel coronavirus is so dangerous and so threatening to all of us, because the supply chain that we've created with this just-in-time logistics only has a limited supply to meet the actual demand, and that demand is going to go up and going to be needed more and more as this disease spreads, and that as you have people go to hospitals with sickness and need for cures, whether they have the coronavirus or not the coronavirus, they're going to go gather. They're going to have flus. We're having a very bad flu season. They're going to have all these different issues, and we're not going to have medicine to treat any of it. This is what people have not yet realized, but this broadcast is ahead of the curve a little bit, and we want you to be ahead of the curve as well in recognizing that there is a critical bottleneck that is worldwide where people are not going to have access to medical drugs like they have had traditionally, starting probably by the end of February, as those supplies which are already in transit have begin being diverted. And as we look at the fact that the quarantines in China, which really are starting to sink in, kind of hit hard last week. So you would think, given the difference in shipping time, what's going to get out, and the reapportionment of what's out there, that really the interruption should start around the end of February, the beginning of March. Not so coincidentally, we look at this spread of the novel coronavirus, which I'm just not going to call COVID because I have a hunch that name's not going to stick. I just call it whatever. I think that the logic on which it's based is going to prove troubling to people, and I've noticed that almost no one is calling it that. So if it becomes commonly used, I'll adapt. For the moment, I'll stick to novel coronavirus until we know that there's a better common usage that people are using. So with the novel coronavirus, what we're going to see is that the disruption to medical supplies is basically going to render most first world medical systems dependent upon antibiotics as inoperable. So voluntary surgeries won't be possible. Basic treatments will become a struggle. And I'm sure that there will be a rush to bring online alternatives. But as we said in the article, the fact that these APIs, or to put more differently, the ingredients for which these drugs are made, are dependent on China, it means we're all going to go through this together. So if it's a very mild epidemic, we will be fortunate in that the only problems we'll have is we can't meet the existing needs of our medical requirements for our people. So I think it's something people really need to be aware of, and that we also have these other areas that there's going to be. There's a lot of food that goes back and forth. Most canned goods, with the exception of certain vegetables, come from China. There's going to be a major loss in food quantity there. There's going to be these disruptions that happen up and down the global supply chain. And beyond that, let's also think of this from a purely financial perspective. You have government spending a whole ton of money to make sure that that the different buyers in the market stay up. You see the central banks doing this, where they're injecting a lot of liquidity into the market, but it's going to cause inflation. And so when the supply shortages arrive, which are already inevitable because we have whole areas of China quarantined for up to another 1 week, 2 weeks, and that we see international travel having difficulties, even if it just lasts for, you know, let's say a month in the best case scenario, and there's absolutely no reason to expect that would actually be the case that resolves, that instead this is still a growing pandemic. It's certainly a growing epidemic in Wuhan, in Chongqing, and all the various different towns, Shenzhen, throughout China, where it is an issue, and all throughout the Hubei province, where the epicenter of the epidemic is. So it's going to cause a major economic problem, and the way that global economics is structured, there are a lot of things that begin to go wrong when you have the second largest economy in the world potentially have a contraction. China hasn't had its economy go backwards since the Great Leap Forward. You'd have to go back to at least the 70s to find a time when there was this much challenge, and now it is the world's second largest economy. So when you look at this, you begin to understand a little bit better why governments perhaps struggle with the balance between truth with the people and the lies that they tell to keep the supply chains moving and to prevent panic. However, this is an inescapable bottleneck, and we will see shortages in supplies. So one of the things that we always recommend so strongly on the Coronavirus Central podcast is to be prepared. So if there are things you're going to need that are made in China, including basic pharmaceuticals, and I understand the nature of the system is such that it's very difficult to lock down those supplies in advance. Nonetheless, we encourage you in the strongest terms to go ahead and get the supplies you're going to need, because they will be difficult to get. And, you know, with respect to the larger economic picture, so many of the major producers in the American and world economy, just use examples like Apple and Amazon, you know, titans of the Dow Jones, require their manufacturing to come from China, and their distribution comes from there. So you're going to see them get shattered at the same time you see prices go up, and the stress on the banks is going to make 2007 look like a cakewalk. And that's assuming that nothing goes wrong with the pandemic here in the United States or in whatever country you live in, because the central banking system pretty much works the same around the world, unless I think you're in Iran, Syria, or North Korea. These are major problems, and they're things that we really need to talk about, because we need to forecast what things are going to look like 2 months from now, 3 months from now. And what we're going to see around the world is probably a markedly higher incidence of novel coronavirus cases, with a medical system that has fewer resources to combat those, with no potential hope of resupply, assuming China continues its descent despite their efforts. And we've seen online plenty of evidence. China's been incredibly vigorous with their quarantine efforts. However, it seems like they're not working, at least in terms of restraining the growth of the virus. And I can't help but think, if it doesn't go back to the night before the quarantine was put in Wuhan, where millions of people left because they knew it was coming into being, and that the party government there enabled that. And that speaks to a question of, you know, why were these things handled this way? I think it's a harder question to answer. We'll have to go into that in the coming days, and we'll explore some ideas. I don't know what we're going to discover, but I think it's definitely worth looking into. So that hopefully gives you a little bit of a background into the economic implications of the coronavirus, the novel coronavirus. And when you look at it, you begin to understand that down the line, just a month or two along the way, we are not going to have a lot of the things we're used to having, including things that our medical system needs in the best of situations, and anticipating that we will not be facing that. So I want you to definitely be aware, be prepared. It's a good time to start gathering things. Look for naturopathic alternatives to your current needs. Some examples for those of you who are worried about infection, you know, for not having antibiotics. Colloidal silver is an old favorite that a lot of people use. Can be very helpful, very useful in these sorts of situations. And you just need to look, depending upon what your specific medical needs are, take the time to do the research, because it really does depend on your specific class of medicine you're using, what other alternatives are, and make sure you have them available. available, because most of us will not be able to get a larger supply. And I would highly recommend that if you have the capacity, ask your doctor to write a script for a longer supply for whatever drug you need, if possible, within the limits of whatever your insurance permits, so that you have access to that. And this is going to be a real problem, because some of the drugs, like psychiatric drugs, drugs that have severe withdrawal symptoms, are not going to be available. And, you know, I know in the United States, it's estimated 1 in 6 people use these to survive. I'm very concerned with how that's going to work in the medium term, where we're going to have people who desperately need help and they won't have access to it. So you better be prepared for that. And I think that's enough for this evening. Right now, what I am tracking and will be looking at tomorrow is just some more detail about the virology of the disease. We'll try to get a little more into that, looking for more information. And really, we're trying to prove what's happening with, you know, the idea of where these bodies are going, how many of them are going to the funeral homes, because that's the key to figuring out what the death numbers are. And while I don't think China knows exactly what they are, the preponderance of evidence suggests that this is far larger than is being reported, and the consequences of the disruptions it's already causing, independent of anything that may happen in your home country or the United States, if you're like me, are such that it's going to be very difficult for this to be concealed too much longer. When it does, we face the real possibility of a market crash, because we've been so set up on debt-driven derivatives, which is basically the market betting on whether things will succeed or fail. There's some good videos on that. The Atlantis Report has several if you want to get a better feel for the economic implications. But here we're going to stay focused on the novel coronavirus, all the broader implications of it. So I want to say thank you for tuning in again. We'll be back tomorrow. I'm aiming to have an afternoon show, which is what we will usually have, but things happen. As always, our thoughts, our prayers go out to the afflicted, to the brave people out there. We just ask that the Lord bless them all, those who are fighting this and those who have suffered from it, that they may find comfort amidst their grief, and that we may find deliverance from this plague before us. So God bless you all. Have a good night. I'll be back tomorrow. Join our group at t.me. It's a Coronavirus Central. We're now closing in on 350 members. We're sharing a lot of intelligence. Just be polite and respectful if you come in. Coronavirus.central.net is the website. Corona.castos.com is the backup of how it works. We do have RSS feeds. For those of you who are listening to this on either iTunes, on Google Play, on Spotify, welcome to the podcast. If you have any thoughts, questions, concerns, inquiries, please send them to me, Tom Kaczynski. I am at coronaviruscentral@pm.me. And if you want extra advice on how to prepare, definitely check out the book Surviving Coronavirus on Any Budget. I was out there doing that myself, actually preparing for that. Do make sure you are prepared for extended economic disruptions to last potentially 3 to 6 months if your means allow and permit, and you know, let other people know. I always tell those who are willing to listen, the best thing we can do is communicate with others so that we're prepared to act together and do so in truth. That's what we do on this broadcast. We definitely put together open source intelligence, and we appreciate you, and we tell you honestly what we think and what's going on, and we try to separate between what we can prove and what we don't know, while recognizing that we're going to have to make some intelligent guesses going forward, all of us, to be able to survive this. So, as I said, everyone have a very nice evening. Thank you very much for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow. Keep safe and make sure you keep clean.